It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
News Podcast presents Bret Baier's All-Star Panel.
America's got to be in the lead if you want to deal with these threats. We're going to lead.
The morning is over. The Shiva is done. And if you're a conservative, you should be optimistic.
You know, my main priority right now is making sure that it delivers for the American people.
We have to make our country great again, and I will do that.
I think the president gets criticized by people all the time for the stuff he says, by people who ignore what he does.
Now, Fox's chief political anchor, Bret Baier.
President Biden is campaigning in Arizona and Nevada this week, hoping to bring out voters in the two states predicted to be particularly competitive in this year's general election come November. Meanwhile, important primaries taking place throughout the U.S., including in Ohio, where a competitive Senate race could reveal how much endorsement power former President Donald Trump still possesses.
Bernie is a fantastic guy. He's getting some very tough Democrat fake treatment right now, and we're not going to stand for it because I know this man. We all know this man. He's a hero. He's a winner. And we're not going to let these people are sick.
Meanwhile, social media is in the spotlight this week on Capitol Hill as the Supreme Court works toward a free speech decision on how much sway the federal government should have when it comes to social media content. And the Senate decides whether to pass the latest bill aiming for a sale or ban of TikTok. To discuss all of this and more, we bring in our panel, Fox News Radio political analyst Josh Krauschauer, Republican strategist Colin Reed, and former Biden campaign surrogate Kevin Walling. Colin, the Ohio Senate race seems the most interesting of the primaries in that there is a Trump endorsement, but it's not clear, you know, if the Trump endorsed candidate is going to sail to victory there.
That's right, Brett. In Ohio is one of those states that went for Trump by 8 points in both 2016 and both 2020, and should be ripe for the pickings for Republicans in 2024 should he nominate the right candidate. And of course, that's always the big if, no matter how friendly the state is or how good the terrain might be. And I will say from the beginning that the Democrats' incumbent Senator Sherrod Brown's a tough out. He's won some tough races before, but he's also pretty far to the left in a state that's pretty swung pretty far to the right in recent years. So this race was pretty consistent for the most part with the Trump-backed candidate, Bernie Moreno, a lead, and then the polls tightened down the home stretch. I know there was a series of outside spending from third-party groups on behalf of Matt Dolan, who's considered to be more of the more mainstream Republican candidate. And then there was a fairly salacious story that broke late in the game about Bernie Moreno and some online activity that was blamed on an intern, always the classic excuse. So it's going to be a close race. And the thing I'd say is a byproduct of former President Trump wrapping this nomination process up so early is there's less incentive. There's less reason for Trump voters to show up and vote because their guy already won the primary. So they did their job as far as they're concerned. So we'll see how long his coattails are down ballot when his race is all but assured.
Kevin, a number of Democrats on the Senate map this time around are listed as vulnerable. Sherrod Brown is one of them in a red state of Ohio. Bob Casey is another. He is, you don't know how he's going to do against Dave McCormick, it looks like. And John Tester is another one. The map doesn't line up for Democrats, but yet they increasingly seem to feel a little bit more confident about their chances in the House and the Senate.
Yeah, Brett, it's a great question. Of course, you know, we're playing defense in a lot of those key states, as you point out. To Colin's point, you know, Sherrod Brown has been able to hang on these last two cycles, you know, kind of outpolling the Democratic base by about 6 or so points. He raised just nearly $6 million in the last 2 months of reporting, which, you know, he's going to be a strong contender. And he runs against the Democratic Party on a lot of different issues. He's also viewed as a progressive to some of the Democrats across the Buckeye State. So he is one of those kind of outliers that overperforms Democratic expectations. And to your question, Brett, so are the other two individuals that you mentioned, Bob Casey and the senator from Montana. You know, hopefully we're going to maybe be on offense, potentially in places like Florida, where we got a former Democratic congresswoman running, and in Texas, too, against Ted Cruz, who remains somewhat unpopular, interestingly enough, in Texas. So, you know, all hopes are on the House, flipping that district. In addition to the Bernie Moreno, Matt Dolan fight, you've also got some key congressional races at play in Ohio, especially. You know, one of the key targets has been Marcy Kaptur for Republicans. She also has held on for a number of cycles. So it'll be interesting to see what candidate the Republicans get behind in that race, too, which could be an interesting opportunity for Republicans to fight back against Democrats come November.
Yeah. And Josh, there are some vulnerabilities for Democrats when it comes to issues. Immigration has been a little tough. You heard from the president in the State of the Union address talking about that. But issue by issue, it seems immigration leads the bunch. Now with the Israel-Hamas situation and the war, how the administration deals with that also is affecting some numbers on the outsides of some of these states.
Yeah, Brett, you have this convergence, especially on the Senate side, between a very difficult political map for Democrats and an issue set that is moving away from the Democratic Party in many respects. Immigration in Ohio, certainly one of the top issues, and it's one that Sherrod Brown has been trying to move a little more to the middle on, but his record is long been much more permissive when it comes to border security. You know, you talked about the issue of Israel and Middle East policy. The Democratic Party's coalition is splitting up over that very fraught issue with a lot of pressure from the left, trying to call for a ceasefire, trying to pressure Israel not to go into Rafah, but a healthy majority or a healthy section of the party, very pro-Israel, very moderate, and thinking Israel needs to finish off Hamas. And the economy, I mean, the issue over whether you should run on the economy, which is doing better than it was a year or two ago, but we're still seeing elevated levels of inflation. There's still a little bit of uncertainty out there. Some Democrats, like starting with the White House, want to run on the president's economic record, but there are a whole lot of Americans still struggling and not really favoring the state of the economy. And that's going to be a really, really touchy issue for any Democratic senator running for re-election. So look, when you combine the political map, which is a bunch of red states, West Virginia, Montana, Ohio, and even more purple states that are going to be hanging in the balance, and you have an issue set that on many of these issues, not all of them, but many of them favor the Republican Party. There's definitely a potential for a wave, or certainly a Republican majority of some margin in the Senate.
Panel, we'll hold it right there.
The Fox News Rundown, a contrast of perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. Your daily dose of news twice a day, featuring insight from top newsmakers, reporters, and Fox News contributors. Listen and subscribe now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
Colin, I mentioned at the beginning about social media becoming more in the forefront politically. We've got the Supreme Court dealing with the communications from the federal government and the administration and what some are calling censorship of speech on those platforms. And there was a lot of questioning in the oral arguments about what the speech element of that is for the federal government in communications with social media companies. But on the other side, on Capitol Hill, you really have a bipartisan coming together on trying to figure out a way to regulate social media, AI, big tech, and it seems like it's crossing party lines.
It does. And it's rare these days in this city that you see anything of remote controversy passing the United States House of Representatives by a vote 300 plus, like the proposed restriction on TikTok happened a few weeks ago. And I know its fate remains uncertain in the Senate right now. But I think that speaks to a broader political trend right now that for all of the divisiveness, for all of the polarization, the one thing that you are still able to find areas of agreement on between the Republican and Democratic Party, and whether it's the populists or the more traditionalists, is this distrust of the Chinese Communist Party. And that was manifested in the widespread support for a restriction on TikTok and ensuring that the CCP was divested from ownership in the platform. And it's something that I think merits a broader discussion, because the CCP has made no secret of their desire to supplant the United States as the economic superpower. And it's been just about a year now since the TikTok CEO appeared before Congress, and it was an unmitigated disaster. And there were so many more questions than there were answers. And I think this bill, this effort, is a byproduct of that happened. And if anything's able to get done in an election year, if anything's able to, of consequence, is able to get done before America goes to vote in a really consequential, divided country, it might just be the ability to say, of all the things that separate us, we still are highly suspicious, highly skeptical, and very dubious of the motivations of the Chinese Communist Party, as well we should be.
Yeah. Kevin, on that TikTok bill, the Senate hasn't committed to bringing it up. Senator Schumer hasn't committed to that. There will be pressure to do that, but there's obviously pressure the other way. TikTok's spending a lot of money on lobbying. And in fact, the former president seems to have changed his tune on the banning of TikTok or divestiture.
Yeah, Brett, it's been interesting to see the former president, President Trump, change his tune to some degree on this TikTok issue. And you're seeing, you know, to Colin's point, the CEO of TikTok making the rounds. I know he was visiting with Senator Fetterman, others now with that House passing that bill. Again, to Colin's point, it's very rare that you see that large of a bipartisan majority, 50-0 on the Energy and Commerce Committee in support of this legislation. But, you know, I think there will be an amendment process play out. I think there's some concerns over the powers that it actually gives the executive when it comes to these kind of companies that have some kind of foreign ownership, foreign stake. And some concerns raised by, I think, some of the kind of chief lieutenants of the former president in the Senate. And you saw Vivek Ramaswamy, others come, really change their tune along with the former president when it comes to this. And you're seeing President Biden, despite campaigning on TikTok, is one of the key constituencies, obviously, is younger voters. And they're spending a lot of time on the app, actually indicate his willingness to sign that legislation, going against now what we see with the former president. So this could be a really interesting election year dynamic with younger voters, the platform, CCP, all at stake in the next, 230 days.
Speaking of another election year dynamic, because it's all these lawsuits against the former president and criminal actions actually brought by a special counsel, Josh. You had this week that the former president saying he's not going to be able to make that bond of $454 million in that New York case. And how much do you think the legal cases, the threat of one of them becoming a trial before the election, is weighing on this electorate? We know what it's done to Republicans in the primary. It's almost solidified them in support of former president. But do we know how independents and, let's say, suburban moms look at this issue?
We know that there are a number of swing voters that certainly wouldn't look kindly upon a convicted felon if that's what a court ended up ruling in any one of these cases, ended up deciding. But we also know that the timetable for almost all of these cases has been delayed, and there have been a lot of appeals in certain cases. So the likelihood of any verdict being handed down before the election is looking a lot more remote than it did a few months ago. So I think, number one, you're not actually seeing Trump, even in a general election, getting any more hurt than he did, at the beginning of the election. In other words, the people who don't like Trump already priced into the election. And there's not been a whole lot of movement, even in the general electorate, since there's been movement on the legal front. I think there would be an impact if there was a verdict, if there was actual movement in an actual case, but it does seem like the timetable is not going to, is not as likely to interact with the political cycle. And that's to Trump's benefit. The longer he can kind of delay and delay, the less likely we're going to have any major impact on the election. And it's going to be judged by the campaign trail. It's going to be judged by whether voters think he's an acceptable alternative to President Biden.
If we're to believe the polls, Colin, there has been movement for the former president in Hispanic communities, in Black communities. The numbers, it's not just one, two, three polls. It's a number of polls. have seen movement, a shift, and sometimes pretty significant. And the question is whether that move will make up for whatever loss the former president may have in independence and suburban women, for example.
That's right. And it's been amusing to see Democrats try and flip the script this week and say, you know, actually, you were better off now than you were 4 years ago by comparing it to the first few weeks of COVID, which were, of course, a terrible period for everybody, and with all the uncertainty that abounded and the lockdowns and everything that came with it, that, you know, history is going to judge kindly or not about leaders and how they acted during the period. And President Trump's going to have his record on that adjudicated by the American electorate. But the reason that a lot of these typical voting blocks associated with the Democratic Party are starting to shift toward the Republicans is they don't, voters don't feel better than they do economically 4 years ago. And to date, the Biden answer has been, actually, the economy is better than you guys feel. You just don't know it. And let me point you to the statistics that are going to make our case. And if that's the best they can do between now and November, good luck. Because if you're asking voters to believe what you're saying or their lying eyes, it's a pretty clear choice. And that is why you're seeing President Trump start to chip away into these really solid, reliably Democratic voting blocks.
But Kevin, in Democratic circles and in punditry that follows politics, the State of the Union address seemed to change things. It seemed to brighten their spirits a bit in that the president brought a forceful argument. He clearly had energy. He was delivering that. Whether you thought he delivered it angrily or not is another, you know, question of style. But they got it, and they needed what to see what they saw. Does that one speech change the dynamic, or do the kind of concerns and the questions continue throughout, you know, this time as we lead up to the conventions?
Yes, certainly, Brett. To your point, I think it allayed a lot of the Democratic fears. Also, too, obviously, the president, you know, was able to raise $10 million, breaking some records in the hours after that State of the Union, and then has hit the ground running, really, you know, traveling to Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin last week. As you said, Brett, at the outset, you know, the president just is on the ground now in Nevada, traveling to Arizona and traveling to Texas. And to Colin's point about, you know, the drop in support, for example, in within the Hispanic community, you know, they launched their effort for Latinos for Biden Harris today. The president spent some time talking to, you know, Latino radio outlets across the country, because there's certainly a fear. And, you know, Brett, you point out it's not just one poll that we've seen the president slippage among Latinos and among African-Americans, which have been key constituencies for the president. And, you know, we're making up ground, obviously, with independents. Some of our latest Fox News polling has the president within the margin of error, especially in a place like Pennsylvania. And he's leading the former president when it comes to, you know, suburban women, to your point, and to independents. But, you know, we've got to also do our base engagement, and not just the president traveling to those key states, speaking to those key constituencies like the Hispanic community, but also the vice president, too, traveling to college campuses, talking about the importance of Roe versus Wade and shoring up that Democratic base, because that's going to be critically important, obviously, come November as well.
And Josh, last thing, do you think that the former president is going to make his choice on a VP early, or it's going to be like one giant episode of Apprentice that we all wait until, you know, somebody surfaces and is the winner of whatever contest there is?
Boy, I think a safe bet is that there's going to be a lot of drama with the vice presidential selection. In fact, that's probably the last big shoe to drop in terms of looking ahead to a repeat from 2020 in the presidential election. And, you know, Trump has a lot of good choices. You know, Senator Tim Scott's name has been mentioned, Elise Stefanik, Katie Britt. There are a lot of governors that could be in the mix as well. So, look, there's a lot of different directions Trump can go. Would he kind of want to double down on someone who represents the MAGA wing of the party? Would he want to complement the ticket with someone who's perhaps more of a traditional pick? Does he want gender balance? Does he want diversity on the ticket? These are a lot of important questions that are probably going to play a notable role in a close presidential election. But if I'm betting about the timetable, Brett, it's going to be drama, and there's going to be a lot of names mentioned before we get a final selection.
Yeah, Colin, I mean, I was on with Hugh Hewitt, and he said, maybe, just maybe, the former president should choose early, use that person as a surrogate to make, you know, not only campaign stops, but fundraising while he's dealing with courts. And he also suggested maybe naming a potential cabinet early so that people say, okay, this is not going to be, you know, a crazy situation.
Well, if there's one thing we've learned in the 8+ years of the Trump era, Brett, it's that he does things his own way, and it's usually an unconventional way. I think Josh hit on a really important point, which is there's so few big moments left in this campaign. It's so unprecedented that we not only have a front runner or a former president running against an incumbent president, but we have the two combatants settled 8 months out. So it's a big moment. There's very few of them left. But I do think if he needs someone out there to occupy himself as this thing wears on, it's an interesting thought. My suspicion on who it'll be is it'll be someone no one's really talking about between now and then. And that carousel of names is going to change a lot of times before we get the final pick.
Well, guys, thanks so much. Appreciate it. Now a bit of history. On March 19th, 1957, Elvis Presley made his first down payment on Graceland. The King of Rock and Roll put down just $1,000 in cash for his home in Memphis, Tennessee, a figure equivalent to just over $10,000 in 2023. Fast forward to today, Graceland has become a historic site visited by countless fans of Presley, making it the second most visited house in America, following the White House. That'll do it for this week. You can hear more of this series at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts. Make sure to leave a rating and a review. We want to hear from you. For Kevin, Colin, and Josh, I'm Brett Baer. We'll see you next time.
Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts, and Amazon Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.